This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being. Neijing is the concept that taking medicines for an illness is like digging a well when thirsty. Neijing Now, placing and taking responsibility for the health of the individual and the planet. From molecular biology to global ecology, from political socioeconomics to psychology and spirituality. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, empowering host resistance. We can be found on the web at neijingnow.org. neijingnow.org. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chandler, and I welcome you to another edition of Exploring Neijing Now. In this first in a series on habits and addictions, Professor Vivas, neurophysiologist at the University of Granada, will explain the physiology of pleasure and addictions.
You feel empty, you need something that you try to cover with RAM.
Dr. Jose Parales, also from the University of Granada, will talk to us about the neuropsychology of addictions.
They prefer to have the rewarding effect of the drug now than to have some other bigger reward.
And Vivian Samano will share her experience of quitting tobacco.
I think I was surprised just how easy it was.
First, the headline medical news. The May issue of the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine reports on a survey of over 26,000 children in 8th, 10th, and 12th grades over a period from 1999 to 2003. The survey found that point-of-sale advertising is associated with kids trying smoking, but not with habitual use. The promotional sale of tobacco products involving price reductions may tempt teenagers who have already tried smoking to become regular smokers. A spokesperson from Philip Morris USA counters that their company carefully regulates in-store promotions to ensure that they are aimed at adults. The study estimates that without advertising, 11% fewer children would try smoking, and if promotions were banned, the number of kids who became habitual smokers would be 13% less. Restrictions on tobacco advertising, price-based promotional sales, and increases in prices and taxes on tobacco products seem to be effective measures in limiting the public and individual toll of tobacco use. The April online issue of the Journal of Adolescent Health published a report on a survey of nearly 2,000 sixth graders in South Dakota. The findings indicate that exposure to alcohol advertising in the sixth grade was strongly associated with drinking in the seventh grade. The most consistent association was with ownership of a hat, poster, or t-shirt advertising alcohol. One-fifth of the sixth graders surveyed owned such an item. These kids were twice as likely to start drinking in the seventh grade compared with the kids who didn't own these promotional items. The president of the Beer Institute criticized studies that link advertising with adolescent drinking and advocated for simply restricting youth access to alcohol. Once again, May 31st was World No Tobacco Day, sponsored by the World Health Organization. This year, the focus is on secondhand smoke and on the progress made around the world in making workplaces and public spaces smoke-free. The United States Surgeon General's report on the health consequences of involuntary exposure to tobacco smoke, released in June 2006, concluded that secondhand smoke causes premature death and disease in children and non-smoking adults. The report notes that no risk-free level of exposure to secondhand smoke exists. It is for this reason that eliminating smoking in indoor spaces is the most effective way to protect non-smokers. Other approaches, including separating smokers from non-smokers and ventilating buildings, are not effective. The Center for Disease Control reports on the National Health Interview Survey of 2005. Of people who tried to quit smoking in 2005, about a quarter used support from family and friends, and about 15% used nicotine patches. About 8% of people who tried to quit smoking used prescription pills, about 7% used nicotine gum, 4% used nasal sprays, inhalers, or lozenges, and 4% used books, pamphlets, or videos. The New York Times reported that the Institute of Medicine, part of the United States National Academy of Sciences, urged Congress and the President to give the United States Food and Drug Administration the authority to regulate tobacco. This would mean the agency could enforce standards for nicotine levels in cigarettes. It could also regulate and track claims made by the industries that claim their products reduce risk. The report clearly states that if federal laws did not exempt tobacco, cigarettes would be banned as they contain cancer-causing agents and dangerous toxins. The Institute of Medicine also calls for higher tobacco taxes and a national ban on indoor smoking in public places. A study published in the journal Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers and Prevention reported that almost half of lung cancer patients started smoking again within a year after surgery for the lung cancer. Most of them started again within 2 months of the operation. This finding is surprising in light of the fact that 90% of lung cancer cases are thought to be caused by smoking. All of the 154 patients in the study had stopped smoking before their surgery and then were followed for 1 year to see if they started smoking again. Patients who quit smoking only immediately before surgery were more likely to relapse. Those who had stronger cravings for cigarettes before their operation and those with less money also had higher rates of relapse. Habits and addictions. When people hear these words, the mind immediately jumps to tobacco, alcohol, and drugs. Yet there are so many varieties of habits. Food habits, exercise habits, hygiene habits, sexual habits, emotional habits, work habits. Our behaviors have a huge impact on our health. Often our habits are health-promoting, and often our habits detract from our well-being. A habit is an acquired behavior that has been followed regularly until it has become almost involuntary. An example would be the habit of looking both ways before crossing the street. A habit is a customary practice, like the habit of shaking hands. A habit is a dominant or regular disposition or tendency, a prevailing character or quality, like when someone has the habit of looking on the bright side of things. It can be a mental or physical character or condition. And finally, a habit can become an addiction. An addiction is the state of being enslaved to a habit or practice, or to something that is psychologically or physically habit-forming, to such an extent that stopping it causes severe trauma. It becomes a compulsion, a need for a substance or activity. Addiction comes from the Latin addictio, meaning to give over or surrender. Although the conversations we present today use addiction to substances as the mode of explaining the physiology and psychology of habits and addictions, I invite our audience to think about the information being presented in terms of their own lives and well-being. Are there lifestyle habits or habits of our minds or emotions that we have become addicted to that are not serving our wellness? Are there activities or substances that control our lives that have robbed us of our freedom and will? Have we become addicted to seeking pleasure and avoiding pain? It is this personal inquiry that I would endeavor to evoke by sharing the conversations I had with these biological specialists with expertise in the field of addiction. Din din na di na di na ta da ta kita taka di 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 kita taka na 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 kita taka ta 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 kita taka gira na gatari kita taka ta tari kita takran ta kita ta kita taka di kita taka tari kita taka geta kena ta kita geta kena ta kita geta kena ta. Professor Vivas is a professor of neurophysiology at the University of Granada, Spain. I spoke to him in his office about the physiology of the brain in habits and addictions. Professor Vivas, thank you very much for taking this time to talk to me. You're a professor of neurophysiology.
I was working addiction for about 10 years in brain central processes of addiction.
Can you tell me a little bit what your research was about?
We are looking for the placement of the pleasure centers. And, well, this pleasure center are very, very related to addiction processes. The main topic is one neurotransmitter, that is dopamine, and one placement, that is nucleus accumbens. Well, first, the brain is very plastic. Our education, our social, environmental, our culture, our family, our friends, our studies. They are more in our brain. Usually we are happy with our family, our friend, our studies, our everything. We don't need anything because our pleasure fountain are in our environment. But sometimes we don't feel good with our family, our friends. And some people need to get other things to get pleasure. The brain has different mechanisms. We can use these brain circuits for another kind of pleasure that we cannot obtain by our natural life.
What are these brain circuits? Can you explain them a little bit?
Yeah, we have brain circuit that is on the basement of the brain, this ventral tegmental area.
The ventral tegmental area.
That is the place where we synthesize dopamine. And dopamine is a neurotransmitter, is the chemical signal, is the main transmitter of the pleasure signal. It's a simplification. Dopamine goes to another nucleus, that is nucleus accumbens. Our brain interprets that it's a pleasure signal. We release dopamine mainly in three conditions. The first is when we are hungry, we eat. For us, it's a pleasure. The pleasure is to eat just when we are hungry, not when we are not hungry. And what substance release in this condition? Dopamine in the nucleus accumbens. We activate some brain circuit and we feel pleasure. The second is when we are thirsty and we drink. Because for our survival, it's very important to eat and to drink when we are thirsty or when we are hungry. And the third condition is important for the survival of the species, that this is the sexual pleasure. This is the three situation and we release dopamine. And what happened with alcohol, cocaine, heroin, amphetamines? These drugs use the same circuits to release dopamine. For example, the alcohol increases the dopamine release in the nucleus accumbens. Amphetamines prolongs dopamine in the nucleus accumbens, and cocaine increases the release of dopamine. Most of the drugs increase the release of dopamine. Where goes this signal from the nucleus accumbens? Well, they go to hypothalamus. They can accelerate respiration. They can increase heart rate. And especially they go to the anterior part of our brain that is called prefrontal cortex. In the prefrontal cortex, we have our desire, our pleasure, and to the limbic system that is the emotional brain. The main question in the drug, they do two main things. One, to activate a pleasure center. Second, for a limited time, we avoid our problems.
Professor Vives, what you're essentially saying is that even though there are these different chemical substances, they have a different chemistry in your body. Like amphetamine is going to behave differently than heroin, and alcohol behaves differently in the body than tobacco. Different enzymes are involved in the metabolism, different effects on the system. But al final, finally, in the brain, they are all releasing dopamine.
Yes, that's true. And when you stimulate these circuits, the brain try to repeat this behavior. If you feel a strong pleasure once, you need to feel this pleasure again and then again and then again. They generate dependence.
Why?
Yeah, because you forget problem, you feel good, you feel pleasure, you feel good. And if you are happy with your condition, I mean, your family, your society, your friends, your everything. You don't need an artificial kind to feel pleasure, because to meet with a good friend is a pleasure. Or to see your, I don't know, to your mother, to your father, is a pleasure when you want to see them. But some people, because social circumstance, has no pleasure because they have no friends or family is not fine, or they have no a good work. They don't have an usual source of pleasure, and it's easier to take
a cheap drug. Or expensive.
Yeah, well, any drug, or to take alcohol.
Is there something that happens in the brain after the pleasure experience is over, that there's like a depletion of the dopamine and then the dopamine receptors are craving the dopamine? Is there something biochemically, physiologically that is happening that is asking for the repeat of the pleasure?
There is two different processes. The use of drug usually produces depression. You take hashish, you feel good, but then the people that repeatedly use hashish in 5-10 years become depressive people. Why? Because in natural condition we have a small and slow release of this transmitter, But drugs release a strong release of dopamine, another chemical signal in the brain, very, very strong. And then the deposits of this amygdala become exhausted. After the feeling, the trip, or the people get very depressive.
Like you're using up all your dopamine or your other neurotransmitters, and then now there's nothing left, and so afterwards you don't have this small and slow, steady release of the dopamine.
Yeah, this is one of the main causes that people need to take drug again and again and again, and usually they need to increase doses because the deposits are empty. They need more, more and more and more stimulus to release the natural chemicals.
It's like you have to dig deeper to find the water.
Yeah, it's a good example. It's the same. First you have the water in the surface, and then it's deeper and deeper and deeper, yeah.
So what about people who get addicted to the natural things that offer pleasure, like people who are addicted to food or people who are addicted to sex? Can you talk about that mechanism?
Yeah, well, this is difficult to explain, and I think this is a psychological problem. When you have stress, you try to get out the stress, eating a lot.
I guess my question is, if you only release the dopamine if you eat when you're hungry, then when you're not hungry and you eat, do you still release this dopamine?
Yes, but it's a disorder. If everything is right, if your life is right, if you feel good, and the eating, you get the small pleasure. But if you are stressing, the brain is not in order, it's a mess. A mess of feeling and stress and angst, and the brain is trying to do something in order to put everything in order. But the result is the opposite. Everything is in disorder, everything is a mess.
Can you explain physiologically the difference between dependence and addiction?
The addiction is a psychological experience, and dependence is physical.
In the same way that there is different physiological mechanisms in the body for different substances, but yet there's a common addictive pathway in the brain. Is there a similar common withdrawal syndrome in the brain? Like alcohol withdrawal behaves differently in the body than heroin withdrawal, or tobacco withdrawal, or caffeine withdrawal. But is there something common in the brain?
Yeah, that they have common pathways.
Often when people quit smoking, they eat more. The effect of food on the body is different than the effect of tobacco, but the pathway of addiction is remaining.
Yes, all people that take drugs has alteration in his eating behavior, in tobacco, in alcohol, in heroin, in hashish, in everything.
Even in marijuana. In marijuana, you end up eating more while you're using.
Yes, because you alter these pathways.
And generally, the appetite is regulated in the hypothalamus.
Yes, the hypothalamus has sensors, for example, for glucose, for sugar.
In terms of the neurophysiology of withdrawal and tolerance,
tolerance is that, for example, if you haven't ever drink alcohol, a glass of wine, you have enough to feel good or to sleep, but time by time, then you need 2 glasses of wine, then 3 glasses of wine, then you need gin, cognac, you need more. And dependence is that they need to drink.
Is there anything happening in the brain that is helping that develop that tolerance, or is it primarily your liver enzymes' capacity to metabolize the alcohol?
Tolerance is mainly a physical process. When you drink alcohol, you induce liver enzyme that they metabolize alcohol. First, the enzyme is in low level, and a bit of alcohol is metabolized without any problem. Then you induce to your liver to have more enzyme, and you need more alcohol. To end the same thing in the brain.
Almost all of the substances that we use for pleasure, is it mostly all metabolized in the liver?
In the liver, yeah. The liver is something like a chemical factory. The liver prepares everything, not only drugs, but when we eat, we have some substance that goes to the blood. These substances are purified by the liver. They put a mark in this substance in order that they go to the kidneys and they eliminate. By the urine or by the bile.
By the bile from the liver.
Yeah, from the liver.
Alcohol generally tends to damage the liver more, and speed and ecstasy, MDMA, they have been associated with more renal failure, with kidney failure.
Yes, yeah, agree. Yeah. But the drugs, the main toxic effects are in the brain. The brain needs a very delicate equilibrium, very, very fine control. And the drug alters this equilibrium.
We started out with the hypothesis that when someone's quote-unquote normal environment is not pleasurable, then they turn to substances or activities to receive pleasure. But we also see people who actually have what appears to be a pleasant situation, and still they turn to either substances or activities, gambling or excessive sexual activity, or even exercise. Can you comment on that?
Exercise is one of our main sources of natural drugs, and people that do exercise, they release a lot of endorphins, a lot of dopamine. In fact, when they have an accident and they cannot practice exercise, they get depressive because they lost the fountain, the source of substance that they are released of the exercise. For example, when you do exercise, you release small quantities of human growth hormone. And this is something like a natural drug. And for you, it's good. It's something you feel good. You do exercise, you take a lot of oxygen, you release hormone, and you feel good. But it's a natural behavior, and that has nothing to do with drugs. Second is people, it's very typical people that has everything. They grow in family, very rich. I have in mind some artist, some singer, that they seem to have everything. But when you read his biography, when he was small, they grew up by a alone. With they don't feel affection, love, family love. You feel empty. You need something that you try to cover with drugs, or to cover with alcohol, or to cover gambling, or doing extreme sport, because you need to release adrenaline, to release something to cover, to fill the vacuum. Yeah.
It's like you feel an emptiness inside, and so you're looking to fill it with this release of dopamine.
We say to tapar un agujero, that is to cover a hole, something like that.
Tapar un hueco.
To ocultar un hueco. So.
And you mentioned endorphins. Can you explain what are endorphins?
The name of endorphins is because the most effective drug to relieve pain is morphine. If we have receptor for morphine, we need to have some substance for this receptor. And at the end of the 70s, they discovered, mainly two substances. Enkephalins and endorphins. And the two substances are related with pain pathways. While the definition of pleasure is that the absence of pain, the absence of pain is a pleasure. The endorphins and enkephalins release the pain and produce something similar to a pleasure. It's not exactly the same concept that before, the dopamine. It's to relieve pain, we feel good. Dopamine is different. That you have a necessity and you cover this necessity. It's two different sides. The door of the signal of the pain is the spinal medulla, and there you have enkephalins. When you hurt strongly, the signal is more potent and they pass to the brain. And
if you get an injury, the signal goes to the spinal medulla and there's a release of enkephalins dependent on the severity of the lesion. So if you release more enkephalins, you feel less pain.
Less pain. It's something like a door that can close and open.
So it modulates or regulates how much pain your brain perceives.
Yes, they can pass more signal or less signal. For example, when you have a small cut, usually you scratch. The scratching stimulates the enkephalin release, and the self-stimulus release enkephalins and control the pain. Acupuncture do the same, is stimulate enkephalin, and this stimulus of enkephalin close the door of the pain. The second stage is the endorphins in the medulla. The endorphin is stronger than morphine. The exercise release the endorphins.
Are there other things that release endorphins?
Stress. The typical example are in the competitive sports. Mm-hmm. They hit hard, yes, but they don't feel pain. Mm-hmm. Or the other people are soldier in the battle. They hit shooting, for example, in the arms or in the legs, and they don't feel nothing because they are very stressed. Mm-hmm. And when you are very stressed, your brain say you need to survive, and they forget everything at the end of the game. They say, wow, I have a pain here, I have a pain here, I have they feel all the pain that they didn't previously.
Is there a way that through the endorphin pathway, people actually get addicted to stress?
Yes. I think it's more related, for example, with the extreme sport. People are very competitive. They need endorphins, feel good.
For example, if you live a very fast-paced life, that kind of stress can release these endorphins, and then you don't feel some of the bad feelings that you feel. And so then you just get addicted to living a very fast and stressful life. when you stop, then you get depressed.
It's a kind of people that need strong, very strong stimulus to live. Live fast, love hard, and die young.
Professor Vivis, do you have anything else you'd like to add about the physiology of addiction?
I think that we covered the main aspect of these behaviors.
I really appreciate your time. You have an expertise in the neurophysiology of addiction that's and also a very sensitive perspective.
Thank you very much.
Tin tin na ti na ti na dha 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 kita taka di 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 kita taka na 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 kita taka ta 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 kita taka dha dha kita taka di di kita taka na na kita taka ta ta kita taka dha kita taka di kita taka na kita taka ta kita taka dha din din taka tari kita tun na katta taka tari kita di na dha di na di di na ti na di di na dha tin tin na ti na ti.
Dr. Jose Perales is an experimental psychologist and full-time lecturer on the Faculty of Psychology and assistant professor on the Faculty of Physical Activity and Sports at the University of Granada, Spain. I spoke to him in his office about the neuropsychology of habits and addictions. Dr. Jose Perales, you were telling me your interest.
I'm a cognitive psychologist. Okay, that means that I'm interested in things like memory or attention or perception or basic learning mechanisms and so on. I became interested in drug taking and drug use because in a way drug using is doing a pharmacological manipulation on the brain, which means that it has important effects on human behavior. We are very interested at the moment on executive processes, which are quite complex psychological processes involved in the general regulation of behavior. Like, for example, when you have to make a decision, taking a lot of aspects of your decision into account.
You called it an executive process.
Executive processes or executive functions.
Like to execute an action or execute a decision.
Exactly. What executive processes do is to organize all the other psychological processes. These people whose executive processes are not working correctly fail very consistently in making a good life and making friends, in making right decisions about what they are going to do with their future. Obviously, it's not the only reasons why drug users fail in their daily lives in many aspects. There are many, for example, social aspects and what society do to you, not only how your brain is functioning. With people who are taking drugs, they prefer to take the drug now and to have the rewarding effect of the drug now than to have some other bigger reward, which is like having a healthy life in the long run. That ability to perform on the long run is something very related to executive functioning. People who have been taking cocaine for a very long time have difficulties in managing rewards, not only in relation to drug taking, but also in relationship to other types of rewards.
For example?
There is a very famous test at the moment, which is called the IGT, the Iowa Gambling Task.
Iowa Gambling Task.
You have four decks of cards, and in some decks, you have an immediate small reward, but from time to time, they provide a very severe punishment. And some other decks provide a small punishment on the trial-by-trial basis, but they provide a very large reward from time to time. So these people have to perform in the long run. If they pay attention only to what's going to happen immediately after the behavior, they would keep on using or selecting or choosing the bad decks. You see, normally you play with points or you play with virtual money. People who have been taking cocaine or MDMA for a long time, they tend to perform very poorly. Normal controls, what they do normally, is to shift from bad decks to good decks as they learn that it's more beneficial for them not to select the immediate reward and to take the delayed larger reward. As you can see, there is no drug taking involved in this task. It's just points and money or virtual money. If drug taking has this kind of effect on the brain, particularly on the prefrontal cortex, which is the anterior part of the brain, they are going to have a very high risk of relapse.
Perhaps they even translate this psychological process of wanting an immediate reward to other things like food or sugar or sex or other pleasures.
What normally happens with all drugs is that they are so rewarding, especially with heroin and opioids in general. The balance of the different rewards you can get in your life becomes completely disorganized. So you normally you have several things to do. You can study, you can play football, you can play with your console, or a lot of things during your day. Some of them are pretty rewarding, and you spend more time trying to get the opportunity to do them. And some of them are less rewarding, and you try to avoid them in some way. When you have the opportunity of taking a drug, that activity is so rewarding that the normal balance of rewards you obtain in your daily life becomes completely disorganized. So in that particular case, it's especially important that you are able to see what are the future consequences of what you are doing. People who don't take drugs do those things without even thinking too much about it. It's mostly intuitive. They have quite complex psychological processes implemented in your prefrontal cortices, and particularly on the ventral part of your prefrontal cortex, and the inferior anterior part of the brain, who are evaluating the consequences of your acts.
Do you actually see physical damage on brain scans?
Well, the damages are quite subtle. You don't see a hole in the brain, but the connectivity in the brain is really damaged. In MRIs, for example, normally you don't see anything obvious. If you put that brain to work, for example, if you make that person to do some kind of psychological test while the functioning of their brain is being assessed, for example, by functional magnetic resonance imaging, what you see is that the activation of quite a complex net of centers in the brain cortex is not functioning in the right way.
Do you think that the disruption of this executive process is actually an effect of the drug taking, or is it a cause of the drug taking?
That's actually a very good question, and there is a big controversy. So there is a risk factor for people to take drugs. So people who are pretty much blind to their future consequences of their acts are more likely to start taking drugs, and at the same time, people who have been taking drugs for some time are more likely to suffer this disruption of the normal functioning of their brains.
Are there other psychological processes that are also causes or effects or risk factors?
We know for sure that memory is quite severely affected, for example, by ecstasy. The situation of ecstasy at the moment is quite a worrying and interesting situation, because we don't have old people who have taken ecstasy when they were young.
It's a new drug.
Exactly. People started to take ecstasy, MDMA, which is the technical name, during the 80s. So all the subjects we have for research are 40-something. We can detect quite important memory deficits in these people. For example, they have problems with lexical access, which means that when they are talking, they have difficulties to find the right word for the right context, which is something you normally find with old people. And that's normally not particularly worrying, especially in healthy people. But what happens when you find people who show signs of subtle deterioration of the functioning of your brain in young people? What's going to happen with those people when they are 72 or 75 or 80-something? So we don't know.
Perhaps we can make some projections based on memory loss that we see in chronic marijuana users, or memory loss that we see in chronic alcohol users.
Between alcohol and MDMA ecstasy, the effects seem to be quite different. But in the case of MDMA, we are seeing quite severe effects on the temporal lobe, on the two sides of the brain. And we know some parts of the temporal lobe, particularly of the medial part of the temporal lobes, are very important for memory. We also know that Alzheimer's disease affects particularly the temporal lobes. We don't know what is causing Alzheimer's disease. We know there are a lot of risk factors. We know that MDMA can cause some kind of harm of the brain, which is pretty similar to the one which is indicative of the initial stages of Alzheimer's disease, which means that a larger deterioration could be pretty similar to Alzheimer's in some sense. The temporal lobe is a very complex structure. There are a lot of connections in the temporal lobe, both within the temporal lobe and between the temporal lobe and other structures of the brain, for example, the prefrontal cortex. When you don't have enough connections in that so complex structure, that structure begins to work in a dysfunctional way.
Can you speak to memory loss in marijuana use?
We have to make a difference between the acute effect of marijuana and the long-term effect of marijuana. There are basically three types of effects of any drug. The acute effect is the one you feel when you are intoxicated with that drug, and it can disappear in several minutes, in several hours, or even in several days for some drugs. There are other effects which are basically metabolic. They respond to the adaptation of the brain to the chronic supply of some substance which is coming from outside. So if you are taking a drug which is an agonist of serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter in the brain, your brain doesn't need to produce more serotonin. So your brain stops producing serotonin in the same rate it used to. And until it recuperates, it starts to produce serotonin again at the same rate. It can take several days, several weeks, and even several months. So those metabolic effects are also psychological effects. And finally, there are the permanent effects. Chronic drug use produces a very severe effect on the long run.
Some drugs can even give you a permanent effect with one use.
Definitely. Especially if they are mixed with some other things and they produce interactions in your body. So you have to differentiate between the acute effects, the metabolic effects, and the long-term effects. So we know for sure marijuana use have a very strong acute effect on memory. If you have a smoked joint now, you sometimes lose the track of what you are saying. You just forget what you are saying because your working memory, which is the memory of what just happened some seconds ago, it's not there anymore. So the acute effect is very severe. So when you are unable to maintain something in your working memory, it's very difficult to codify that information in the long-term memory. If you try to study something, if you try to memorize something under the effect of marijuana, you are probably going to do pretty badly. But it's not so clear about what happens with memory on the long run, because it's very difficult to find people who have taken large quantities of marijuana in the past and are not taking marijuana now. It's quite difficult to discriminate the acute effects and the metabolic effects, which are quite short-term effects, from the long-term effects. There is something there.
Right, so what you're saying is that marijuana users in general tend to be chronic users, and yes, that it's very difficult to find people to study who have stopped using marijuana in order to determine if they have chronic memory loss.
Exactly, it's the perfect way to describe what I was trying to say.
So, Dr. Perales, what predisposes people to shift from a drug use to drug addiction?
People who are generally unmotivated are people who tend to choose immediate rewards over long-term larger rewards. Definitely that personality trait is related to the risk of starting taking a drug or even making the shift from drug use to drug addiction.
Dr. Perales, do you have any comments about the difference between the psychological factors involved in illegal drug use and legal drug use?
I don't make a difference between legal and illegal. So the reasons that make a drug legal or illegal has very little to do with the damage that a drug can cause. Alcohol is much more dangerous than marijuana, for example. I'm not saying that marijuana is not dangerous. It is. There is no drug at all which is completely innocuous. Nicotine is harming. Marijuana is probably harming. Alcohol is harming. Heroin is obviously very harming. But for me, the division between legal and illegal has no scientific meaning. And definitely alcohol is very harming, not only on your brain, also on your liver, but particularly on your brain, because we know it's very toxic, and we know it kills a lot of neurons in different parts of your brain, but it's legal. So there is no reason why alcohol should be legal and marijuana should be illegal. I'm not saying that all the drugs should be banned. I'm not saying that all the drugs should be permitted. But we should to think a bit more deeply about why some drugs are illegal, some of them are legal. When people started to take MDMA, ecstasy, in the 80s, they used to see that ecstasy was the clean drug. But what you are finding is completely different. What you are finding is it's very harming.
I remember this very clearly, people talking about ecstasy being a clean drug. And I think there are also groups of people who feel that there are natural drugs, quote-unquote, and chemical drugs, quote-unquote. So if you take mushrooms and marijuana, then you're in the natural department, the organic shop. And if you're taking other more processed drugs, you're in the chemical department.
All drugs are natural. All drugs come from nature, and they are more or less processed. But the fact that something hasn't been processed in a certain chemical way doesn't mean that that drug is not harming. With marijuana, here in Spain at the moment, which is particularly liberal, And we have a lot of people who say, well, marijuana, especially if you smoke it directly from the plant, it's not harming at all, so you can smoke as much marijuana as you want because the effects are going to be non-harming. But what happens with people who are 12? Because the brain is still developing, and we are providing some external substance we know for sure is affecting the developing process of, for example, the prefrontal cortex. It's not the same to start taking marijuana when you are 12 than when you are 18.
What I've seen in clinical practice anyways is that chronic marijuana users tend to have lower motivation and lower drive to get things done.
Exactly. They are anhedonic in the sense that they seem to show no interest for life. In the case of alcohol, you become much more impulsive when you take alcohol, especially when you are under the effects of alcohol. Anything that can be harming for your health and for your future is more likely if you take alcohol. That's obvious. That's something we all know. Alcohol taking is very much related to the initiation of using other drugs. I'm not so sure with nicotine. It's very rewarding, which is that nicotine is very addictive. It's not so clear that nicotine can affect your behavior. It can be relaxing in some contexts. It can be exciting in some other contexts. It's a bivalent drug. People who have difficulties in detoxing from nicotine can't have also difficulties with detoxing from other drugs. People who are in risk of smoking are probably a bit more in risk of taking other drugs. If we accept there are permanent personality traits which are related to your tendency to do rewarding things which are harming in the future.
Or simply if you turn to a substance to relieve your stress.
Exactly. You know, drugs which are legal and a lot of doctors are prescribing Valium or Trancillium on it as if they were aspirins. They are not aspirins, they are drugs and they have profound effects.
One of the aspects of using illegal drugs versus legal drugs is there's a certain psychology of secrecy and illegitimacy of separating the people who are in and the people who are out of your group. There's the people who know and who are on the inside of illegal drug use, and then there are the people who can report you or book you or bust you. You know, so there is a certain psychology around the difference between illegal and legal drug use. Can you comment?
Yeah, definitely. Just seeing what's happening in society, there is obviously, we can see dynamics of belonging. Even if taking drugs takes you out from society in a way, the fact that they know you are taking a drug make them think that you are doing some other things, which are not directly related to drugs, but from their point of view, belong to the same stereotype. On the one side, people from outside the group make some attributions about you, which can be harming for you. But at the same time, the use of a drug can give you a sense of belonging to a group. These are the people, in a way, support you, share with you a number of values and a number of ideas about life. Especially if you work with people, for example, with young people in high school, you see that drug taking gives you some charisma. So inside the group, the attributions they make about the person who is taking the drug can be completely opposite. Positive attributions inside the group can become negative attributions outside the group. We are trying to prevent drug use from outside. If you are the person who is in charge of making policy, if you are a person who in a way represent that policy, if you are the teacher, or if you are the physician, or you are the person who advertises against the use of drugs, you are outside. You are not part of my group, which means that I don't pay attention to you at all, because my group tells me that I'm special or I'm better in some way because I'm doing this.
Or simply that you belong.
You belong to that group, and you feel supported by that group.
This is an important psychological need.
Yeah, definitely. You don't need to be a psychologist to reach that conclusion, because we have been teenagers, and we know how important it was for us.
I think it goes beyond adolescence, though. I think it's kind of a basic human psychological need. People are always associating themselves, identifying themselves as part of a group.
So if when you are an adult, you pertain to a number of groups. You can be a dancer, you can be a worker, you can be an academic, you can be a footballer. I don't know, you can be many things at the same time, and you can belong to many groups at the same time. But when you are young, when you're a teenager, the number of groups you belong to is much smaller, which means that the power of the group is much larger, is much bigger.
Well, and it's interesting that teenagers or children should feel that they don't belong when they so clearly belong within a family. Perhaps there's a change in the structure of the family or the feeling of the family that doesn't give them an adequate sense of belonging to the family.
Yeah. On the one side, we are saying that family is important, but at the same time, we are giving them a lot of messages, saying them that they have to look for happiness outside the family. So basically, clothing or video games or sports sometimes, many times, are a way to adapt to other groups, not to the family, but to the kind of group they belong to in the high school, for example, to the equals, to the peers.
You think that message is coming from the family?
Some of them are definitely coming from the family.
What about people who start drug use later in life? Like there are people who start smoking when they're 30, 35.
It's more difficult to find people who start taking drugs when they are 35 than when they are 18. Just because, in part, because the maturation of the brain has finished. It finishes approximately about the age of 20, 19, 20 is the age at which the process called myelinization of the white matter in the brain finishes. We are receiving the message that we have to behave in a certain way. We have to keep young. We have to be individualistic. We are receiving a lot of, I would say, subtle messages from society. Probably what you have seen in clinical practice is that there are people who start taking drugs just because they are unhappy, because they are looking for something they cannot find, in part because they have lives that don't give them the kind of rewards they are looking for. Society advertising and your peers and your group is saying that some things are very important. At the same time, they don't give you the opportunity to reach those natural rewards. So you probably look for escape. I'm not saying that's the only explanation. But I could say that the reasons that make them take drugs have a lot to do with not the kind of life they have, but the kind of life they are pursuing. In every age, the general way you behave, how you distribute the different activities you perform during your day, have a lot to do with the rewarding contingencies. The rewarding contingencies are the consequences, the good and bad consequences of the things you do. There is something called the behavioral balance, which is the point. So if you give a person freedom to behave the way they normally behave, the time they dedicate it and the number of activities reaches a certain point in which we say there is some balance. We call it the behavioral equilibrium. The point in which that equilibrium is reached has a lot to do with what you obtain. You tend to optimize the degree of reward you obtain with the things you do. If there is no way to reach an acceptable point of equilibrium, if the satisfaction you obtain from those things is not the one that has been promised, the possibility of taking drugs can have a lot to do with the attempt to reach a new point of equilibrium. To understand what people do, you have to understand what's happening with his or her complete behavioral system.
I think that's actually very well said. Can you explain the psychological difference between dependency and addiction?
Well, there is a popular sentence for that, which is actually pretty true. If you control when and how you take the drug, you don't depend on the drug. If the drug controls you, you depend on the drug and you are an addict.
There's no difference between addiction and dependency?
You can use the term dependency in a strictly physical sense. You are dependent when there are withdrawal symptoms, when you don't have the opportunity to take the drug. Addiction is probably a broader term, obviously includes dependence, but at the same time includes the psychological factors which make the drug control your behavior. What is the point in which you shift from one point to the other? Because in the very moment in which you start to take drug, you alter that point of equilibrium in your behavioral system. I wouldn't say a person who have taken cocaine 3 times is an addict, but a person who have taken cocaine 3 times could be an addict, depending on what is the importance of the drug on the behavioral system of that person. You cannot make a definition of addiction which is separated with the person you are assessing. It's a question of developing an equilibrium of your behavioral system that is causing you more problems than advantages or more harm on the long run than benefits on the short term.
Well, this has been a very interesting conversation.
I really thank you for the opportunity of having this conversation, which has been very rewarding for me as well.
It's been very interesting and very informative.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tin tin na ti na ti na ta 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 kit ta ti gain ta 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 kit te te kata gadi gen ta gain ta ta gain ta ta gain ta.
Vivian Samano is teaching English full-time in Madrid while simultaneously doing her master's degree in education. I spoke with her at her home about her experience with quitting smoking. Vivian, thank you so much for offering me this interview.
Thank you, JC. I'm happy to be here.
So I want to congratulate you on successfully quitting smoking.
Thank you.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you quit smoking?
Well, I was actually kind of a heavy smoker when I was back in the States. I was able to quit temporarily, and then I started again. The one thing, like, strangely enough, that helped me quit smoking was moving to Madrid, which is very surprising because most people think of Europe as being a place where everyone smokes, you have cafe culture, bar culture. But for some reason, it had the adverse effect on me. I was going out a lot when I first arrived. I would walk home and I would just smell like a giant ashtray. And I began to realize, I think, the damage I was doing to myself. And I started to think about that every time I started smoking. And at some point, I just said, I don't want to do it anymore.
Can you tell me when you started smoking and a little bit about your smoking history?
Well, I was smoking off and on really casually, probably from the time I was like 16. But I didn't actually start really smoking until I went away to university at 19. I was very stressed. Also, I was very anxious. It was easier for me to deal with being outside and speaking with people because I had a cigarette than it was just to sort of go outside and like relieve tension and just start talking as well, because I think I was quite reserved and a little bit shy. So at that point, for some reason, I went the transition from being kind of just somebody who occasionally smokes to somebody who starts smoking on a daily basis. It was actually kind of a form of relieving anxiety on a couple different levels.
And how much were you smoking a day when you were at your peak?
If I were just having a normal day, maybe almost a pack a day. If I was going out, well over a pack a day. I was sometimes smoking half a cigarette, butting it out, and then continuing it later to reduce it. But if anybody's ever tried, this is the most disgusting thing in the world. And I don't recommend it.
What's disgusting about it?
There's some way that like the smoke gets trapped into the cigarette, so that when you actually smoke the remaining part of the cigarette, it's really just tastes like sulfur and poison, which is maybe what it should taste more like to actually get people to quit smoking.
How many years were you smoking?
6 years, more or less. But that is a very heavy smoker. Before then, I was just a social smoker.
Can you tell us a little bit about the process of quitting smoking? I mean, you said that you really quit smoking when you came to Madrid, but you had tried a few times in between, is that correct?
Every time I tried, I didn't change any other activity in my life. I would replace the cigarette with like chocolate, or I'd replace it with anything. And I didn't actually make any changes. So I started making sure I was doing activities that were difficult for me. My lungs were in such bad shape, I think. So I started purposely making myself take longer walks. I started purposely making myself go jogging. I started purposely always taking the stairs instead of the elevator, because if you smoke, that's the most miserable thing you can do. And when you quit smoking, you start to see every day it becomes a little easier. And you have to do something that helps you notice the changes and the improvements of your life and your body without smoking. Also, that something that makes you, I think, realize the damage you've done beforehand. So that was the only real thing I was able to do. Instead of replacing the cigarettes with something, I just made a change in my life and it helped.
That's very interesting. That's fantastic. Can you talk a little bit about what it felt like when you quit smoking?
I felt really emotional at the beginning, and I felt like I'd lost my best friend, and which I think a lot of people describe having. And I realized, though, how much of it was psychological. It's funny because I had pneumonia and I still continued smoking at some point after I recovered from pneumonia. So I was pretty deeply addicted, because everyone talks about how it's so emotionally and physically difficult to do it. But they say the actual physical craving is out of your body within 2 to 3 days. So I just had to keep reminding myself that everything was psychological. That made it a bit easier. I'm like, everything is in my mind, so I can control it. That's what helped me do it.
How does one control your mind? Because really the mind is maybe even more difficult to control than the body.
I was actually practicing Vipassana at the time. One thing I went to was Anapana breathing a lot to help me kind of gather myself and to help me observe myself, which I'm actually not practicing as much now, and I should, but it really helped me get a hold of myself, get a control of myself, observe everything, know that everything is temporary and let it pass. I think I was surprised at that point just how easy it was to quit smoking in that way, because even though I was doing all these replacement activities, when I'd done it before, I was like crying all the time and unhappy and depressed, but I was really able to get myself together. And it's been like over 4 years now without smoking.
Wow, 4 years is great.
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever go back because I feel so much better now and so much more controlled and so much more leveled. And it's so nice to not be dependent upon something for some peace of mind. Yeah.
That's great. Can you explain to our listeners a little bit what you mean by practicing Vipassana and going to Anapana?
Observation through meditation. And with Anapana breathing, you just focus on your breath. You focus on a concentrated area and you focus on your breath. It's a way to get your mind together in stressful times. I go back to it sometimes now, even though I'm not practicing as meditation as much as I used to. But I was doing it at that point about half an hour a day to an hour a day. It really, it helped me.
So Vipassana is a form of meditation and Anapana is an element within that of just paying attention to your breathing.
Exactly.
Can you tell me, did you go cold turkey or did you step down or did you use any medications or any help from a doctor?
I didn't use any medication. I didn't use any help from a doctor. What I did was I had one pack, and that was my golden emergency pack. And I smoked it until I was done. I rationed it out until I was ready, but I made sure I was never going to buy a pack after that, and I never bought a pack after that.
And you never bummed off of other people.
And I never bummed off of other people, no, because I decided that pack, I invested this pack with these kind of magical properties. And I just told myself, after this is the last pack that I will ever smoke, and I haven't smoked since then, so.
And you had quit before.
I'd quit before, it hadn't really stuck as much.
What do you think was the difference?
I think it was just that I finally took a strong decision in my mind to do it, and it was about the mental work that I was really ready to be there, as opposed to just saying, I'm going to do it, and not having the strong dedication. All the physical sensations were the same, but I think it was taking the strong mental decision that helped me quit.
And you probably had to face some of your emotions more acutely this time around.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I never thought of it in those terms. I just thought, I have to do it. It was because at the time I had just moved abroad, so I'd taken a strong decision to that. I just had decided to change my life's path, decided to change my career, decided I wouldn't come back to the States. So I'd been taking all these very strong mental decisions at the time. This was just one of them. It was just a part of it.
4 years ago, you also married a smoker. How is it being a non-smoker married to a smoker?
It's not really a problem, actually. It just means sometimes I have to say, hey, the smoke's blowing my way. I don't feel any kind of pressure to smoke again. I don't feel any temptation anymore. Actually, the sad thing is now that I've quit smoking, he started smoking more than when I was a smoker. I mean, he sometimes makes the joke that now he's smoking for two. He has no explanation for it. I have no explanation for it. It's just one of those strange things that's happened.
You never feel any cravings when you go to a bar or to a party where people are smoking?
Absolutely not. Actually, I feel the opposite. I kind of smell the smoke in my hair and I say, oh God, I can't believe I put that in my body for so many years, because at least now I can wash it off.
Any sage wisdom for other people who are trying to quit smoking?
Just remember that because the physical addiction is out of your body so quickly, it's simply something with the mind. It's something you can control, and it's something that you can do as long as you take the strong effort to do it, as long as you make small changes in your life, as opposed to replacing smoking with something else.
With another addictive substance.
Exactly. Or even like food or anything, just don't replace it with anything else. Just change your daily routine and activity, and you'll see how smoking just doesn't fit into that.
Do you think that there are people who might need the help of a physician or need the help of medication?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that for some people, particularly people who've been smoking for even longer than I have, they may need that. And there is that support available and there are excellent resources. And I definitely would recommend those.
Thank you so much, Vivian. It's been really interesting and been very helpful.
Thank you, Jaycee.
The craving for pleasure is a pit of discontentment. To indulge in craving is to sink deeper. To be oblivious is to drown. Neijing Now was written, edited, recorded, and produced by Dr. Jayashree Chander. Editing assistance and translation, Alok Mahendru. Sound engineering advice, Budhaditya Chattopadhyay, Geeta Pandye, Alok Mahendru. Website setup and design, Srinivas Pakanati and Dirk Polson. Tabla and Manjira played by Jayasi. Bass guitar by Pedro Ordonez. Drum set by Jisi Garcia. Compositions from Pandit Swapan Chaudhary. Concluding poem written by Jayasi. Distributed by Gypsy Jace Productions. Found at gypsyjace.net, gypsyjays.net. You can find us on the web at neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org.